You're listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on bingemedia.net. And now, the Binge Aftertaste.
As you know, we've entered into a contract with the city to run local law enforcement. But at Security Concepts, we believe an efficient police force is only part of the solution. No, we need something more. We need a 24-hour-a-day police officer, a cop who doesn't need to eat or sleep, a cop with superior firepower and the reflexes to use it. Fellow executives, it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to the future of law enforcement.
My friends call me Murphy. You call me...
RoboCop. Who is he? RoboCop. What is he? RoboCop. Where does he come from?
Dead or Alive Binge listeners, you're coming with us to the Binge Movie Aftertaste RoboCop Retrospective Series.
Called for backup.
Join Garrett, Matt, and Batch as they watch and review all three films of the original RoboCop film series before finishing with the 2014 remake.
You have 20 seconds to comply.
Listen to this series of shows in which the hosts promise to serve the public trust by breaking down what went right and wrong with the tales of Alex Murphy making the Detroit streets a safer place.
Well, I guess we're going to be friends after all.
Richard. So bitches leave, as the adventure-seeking podcast listeners will be staying out of trouble by taking this journey to find out what Prime Directive 4 really consists of.
Though you may think you're having fun now, you only hurt the one you love.
Which is all brought to you courtesy of Binge Media.
Let's do this. Tin Man.
RoboCop, released July 17th, 1987. Budget on this was $13 million. Box office of whopping $53.4 million and is directed by the ever-crazy Paul Verhoeven. I'm Garrett. Welcome back to another Binge Movie Aftertaste retrospective. I am joined once again by, as he coins himself, I guess he's just my new permanent co-host, Mr. Matthew Goudreau. What's going on, Matt?
You can loosen the restraints. I promise this time I won't run away. I'll do it on my own fruition. Good God.
Well, just to give a little bit of a backstory, this was going to contain one of the original OG3, Mr. Ammon Gilbert. Things come up in life, though, and Ammon had to pull out, and what did I do? I just went back to my go-to and just called Matt up and said, dude, I'm in a bind. I need another co-host, and Matt, as always, you come through full circle. Even the day after you became an uncle, and you've been up for a grand total of, I would say, about 26 hours at this point, right?
Yeah, quite some time. Feels like, much like these aftertastes, I'm stuck in a time loop in the 80s, because why would you not get a guy who actually didn't live through this decade?
It's interesting you say that. I was going to bring that up during the course of this podcast. Yes, Ammon is about the same age as me and Batch. And Batch, I'll get to you in a little bit, so stop itching to get into the conversation. I know you really want to talk because you love talking. But hold on a second. So I think you bring an interesting perspective in that you didn't live through the era that this was in, and you're bringing a fresh set of eyes to it. Yes, it does help that if you knew, you know, the Reagan era and everything that was going on, that's explored in this movie. But I think your perspective is what I gravitate to the most, because it is a fresh set of eyes that, you know, you weren't even born when this fucking movie came out. You were 11 years from being born when this movie came out. So I find that interesting perspective, and I'm glad you're on the podcast, because it helps me think about it from your set of eyes. And that's what I really look for in these things.
Gotcha.
And, all right, we'll finally get to him. The host of Small Screen Heroes, the one and only, Binge Media's own, Mike Bastor. What's going on, Batch?
Shout out to Ammon for breaking up the team of Batch and Ammon that was on the retrospectives. But life gets in the way. We're soldiering on.
Uh-huh. How you doing, bud? I haven't spoke to you in been quite a while. It's been at least 6 months.
It's been a while. I've been on vacation, just like John McClane in our last ones. Not bad. Not bad. Yeah, Gamecast has gone on hiatus for a bit, so I'm just focusing on Small Screen Heroes over at The Binge Media. Happy to be here to talk some RoboCop today.
RoboCop today, and for the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to cover the two sequels as well as the remake. I thought about including Prime Directives, that beautiful set of movies from your home country.
Oh, we should.
Batch, but you know what? That is an extra set of movies that I really don't want to sit through again.
Were they movies or were they a TV show? Or was it a TV show and a movie? Or did they just like repackage those for the States?
I think they just repackaged them.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to put Matt through that. And I didn't really want to sit through those again. I did it one time in my life. And,
I've suffered enough.
Well, just like other binge media shows, I'll watch them so you guys won't suffer half. And I'll talk about them like upcoming episodes. So that's what I do around
That'd
here.
Be awesome.
I watch the shit no one else on the staff wants to watch. So.
That's a great point. You do. Although you have a great show over there. You've had my announcer, Adam Bunch, on your show a couple times. I enjoy the show you guys do over there. Matt, I'm sure you haven't listened because you're not a loyal follower of the site. Batch has a pretty good show over there. It talks about all things comic book, including movies and the actual comic books and TV shows. And they've had episodes dedicated to Arrow. And it's been it's interesting to listen to, man. So keep that up. Why don't?
See, I want to pitch two more shows to the network. One, Better Call Batch. And two, The Bachelor. Me and Ammon doing a Bachelor report.
Yes, that would be awesome. But let's get to what we're talking about today, boys. RoboCop. This is a movie. I'll get to my interpretation of it later, as far as how I came into it. Let me go to Batch first. Batch, how were you first introduced to this film?
I was way too young to watch this movie when it first came out, but that was like half the fun. Like, what year did this movie come out?
87.
87.
This is 1987. Yep.
So I was born in 75. So yeah, around 12 years old. Perfect age to watch a violent sci-fi masterpiece like this film.
Ah, he's showing his hand a little bit. So you... too young, but you still did you see it at the movies? Did you wait for video?
No, it was like it was on video. Like as I mentioned last time with the Die Hard trilogy, it was like when back in the day when you used to pirate the like three movies on a videotape. So I think this was on the same videotape that actually had Die Hard on it.
Interesting.
So that was a good 1-2 punch. And I think Predator was the third one.
Oh wow. Dude, that tape must have gotten worn out within like a year.
You have no idea.
Matt, what was your first intro to this film, sir?
Not until I was in college. It was just...
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't one of those things where I put off avoiding watching it because it was one of those movies that I had heard about so much. And, you know, I was when I was really getting into movies in middle school and high school, it was just one of those things like missing. I just couldn't find the time to sit down and watch it. And then when they announced the remake, probably a couple of years before it actually came out, that's when I sat down and watched... the first one, at least, and then I didn't watch the subsequent sequels until the remake came out. So I don't have that youthful attachment to it like some people do. It's certainly etched in the back of my mind as far as I knew who RoboCop was growing up, but it just wasn't a property that I watched until later in life.
Fascinating. This is a movie I was introduced to it pretty late, actually. I watched it. This is a stupid way to watch this movie the very first time because it would seem like back in the 80s, this would be like an action-packed 45-minute film if it was on TV, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Because there's not much you can really show on regular TV in this movie. But that's how I very first watched it. I watched it. It was like a late-night primetime debut of this movie. It must have been 80. At that point, it took about 2-3 years for it to show on TV, so it was about 88, 89. I think it was like on the ABC TV. I think I taped it and I used to watch it all, but that was like the edited version, which was weird because there'll be certain scenes I'll bring up where it's just like, you know, you have Boddicker's great lines and you don't even get to hear them because it's all edited out for ABC television.
Witches leave.
And I'll be. Yeah. Girls leave. It doesn't have the same effect.
No.
The ABC Family version, that's just like a 10-minute movie.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I'll be honest, you know, just watching that version of it and just when I finally did watch the regular version of it, which was a couple years later, I have never been a huge fan of this movie. And we'll get to the sequels when we get to them. But it was never a series I loved getting into, which is why I wanted to do this retrospective, because I think the last time I watched these was exactly as mad. I watched them when the remake was coming out, and I did reviews for them over at the Amigos. And I was kind of preparing for this movie to come out. That was back before I did, you know, podcasts to prepare for these things. So that was the last time I watched them. I wanted to watch them again, and I wanted to kind of see what my perspective would be like years later coming back to it. So it's I might be what everybody hates about this network. I'll go ahead and put that out there me being on this network. But just given Verhoeven's style and everything that comes with this movie, you know, the writing of it and everything, or you either love it or you don't. And I don't love it. So that's pretty much the perspective I bring to it. It wasn't really something I loved watching Die Hard. I love that I love that violence. I love that action violence. I even love Predator and Star Wars and such. But when it came to RoboCop, I didn't really revisit it too much as a kid.
Yeah, of Verhoeven's sci-fi action films, the mergers that he did, I find myself gravitating, no pun intended, towards Total Recall more.
One thing about all of his movies, at least his American movies, is that as they originally conceived, they were much different. And the style he brought to them, again, you either love them or you hate them, right? I mean, Total Recall, as originally conceived, I think David Cronenberg was going to do it. And he wanted Peter Weller in that role, as a matter of fact.
He wanted Richard Dreyfuss.
Wow, that'd be a completely different film.
Yeah, Peter Weller would go on to do Screamers, which is also based on Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, it would have been a completely different film. I agree, Batch. The over-the-topness you couldn't bring to a movie with Richard Dreyfuss as the main protagonist.
No.
So I think what he brought to that matched that style. But when it comes to RoboCop, in fact, it's funny you bring up Schwarzenegger, because Schwarzenegger was actually who Verhoeven wanted for this role. They found that just putting the stuff on him and, you know, having him in the suit would just look ridiculous, and little did they know.
He couldn't move in the suit because it'd just be too restricting.
Absolutely, and little did they know, 10 years later, he proved that in Batman and Robin. I mean, have you seen him trying to move in that fucking suit in that movie? It's ridiculous. Peter Weller was pretty much the last person they wanted as this character, and I think, you know, you look at Peter Weller's career, and I think leading up to this, I think he thinks of himself as a quote-unquote actor. I've seen him speak. He thinks very, very highly of himself. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he kind of threw himself into this at the time, sci-fi wasn't really looked at as something to jump into. It was kind of like quote-unquote slumming it. I don't really think he wanted this role. I mean, he did go into it. I mean, he did miming to get the movements down. Once he delved into it, he was fine. But I don't know if he really looks back on this and thinks that he's glad that RoboCop is the huge movie on his resume. That's our look at, you know, our first look at RoboCop. What do you say we get into the movie, boys, and we start the retrospective off, huh?
Yeah, man.
We start off, we see the Orion Pictures logo, which probably not for Matt, but for Batch, I'm sure that brings back some good memories.
A whole lot of memories.
That logo, that was a big thing in the 80s. Orion was a huge fucking company. You remember that, right, Batch?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were more of an artist-driven company. In fact, we spoke about them, Matt, in our Hannibal retrospective, because they were responsible for Silence of the Lambs and Dances with Wolves, both movies that won Oscars for them. And then they are the only company that has movies win Oscars and do box office, but then fall under. I'm glad that they gave Verhoeven as much artistic freedom as they did, but they did that for every director. They kind of caused them to fold. But anyway, so we see the Orion Pictures logo, and then we get an overview shot of Detroit. Then we get some newscasts that detail what's going on in the environment our hero is going to take on. And boys, I love this stuff.
Because Detroit's a shithole, big surprise.
Well, there goes our Detroit listening audience, Batch. What they did was they predicted what was happening. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. Detroit and financial upheaval, that would happen literally like 20 years later. It's crazy.
Now, what year does this movie take place in?
They just say near future.
Yes.
So 2017, 2018.
Because I'm trying to think. I don't even think in the remake they give a specific year.
No.
Mm-mm. Boys, how do you guys feel about these newscasts? You have Sleaze Gibbons, you know, Lisa Gibbons. She's big on Entertainment Tonight back in the day. Her and this guy, they're introducing these newscasts to tell the story of where we're up to it today. And then we have the ads. And I feel that actually all this stuff kind of frames the social commentary this movie's going to take on rather nicely.
Well, it has the same kind of vibe like Starship Troopers has, like in terms of that framing device.
Yeah, and it's a great way to give expository dialogue that sets up your universe without 20 minutes. I mean, it's an efficient way to do it, but also it's kind of a microcosm for the what this movie is on the whole as far as just how much it predicts about society we'd see in the near future. And it starts right away with Detroit being the kind of this rundown, crumbling metropolitan area, although it wasn't necessarily that far out of the picture. I mean, historically, this is coming out during a period where there were parts of New York that were pretty much unlivable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like, infrastructure was coming apart. So it's, I don't know if it was necessarily Detroit, but there were certainly metropolitan areas that were almost as bad as what we see in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Another sidebar, this wasn't actually filmed in Detroit. This was filmed in Dallas, Texas. They looked at Detroit, but Verhoeven hated the way it looked. He didn't like the way the skyline was. Like, he wanted a good skyline, and he found all that when they went to Dallas. Yeah, it's not actually filmed in Detroit, but the way they frame it, I mean, it just looks like a shithole in this movie. It's just, you know, all these dystopian movies we see later on, it's pretty much, you know, this is where we can see it really start to come to fruition.
It's funny, like, a lot of the movies in the 80s don't necessarily hold up. Now, I think the tone and the look of this film actually really holds up still in this year.
Yeah, I agree. You know what helps it hold up for me? And I'm looking at it, and it does have, like, this 80s feel, of course. It's got that 80s sheen to it. But it also has this weird, like weird 70s vibe, too. You know, like, this could literally have come out in the 70s. Just the attitudes and everything, all the debauchery that goes on. It feels more 70s to me than 80s, which is to its advantage, I think. Mm-hmm. So we learn that OCP is now funding the Detroit Police Department, and we also learn that the name Clarence Boddicker for the first time. We'll get to him later. We meet Murphy, played by Peter Weller, and he's thrown right into the outhouse known as the Detroit Police Department. Anyone else find it odd that he's transferred from OCP, like they're almost setting him up to be RoboCop? Why is he transferred from a place where he hasn't really been around the crime that Detroit's going to bring up out? You know, it's almost like they set him up to be RoboCop in a way. That's the way I took it.
Well, I think it's just giving them an excuse because they know how much of a shithole it currently is. So there's a higher chance that you just throw them in the fire. It's almost kind of like you can almost look at it as an allegory for Vietnam, where it's like they were just throwing people into the wood chipper because they didn't think you were good at anything else. You were just like infantry.
Yeah.
And I think I think Murphy is a character. He's just like an everyman. Like, he's not like the Sly Stallone here. He just wants to do his job and protect people. And maybe he just looked at joining the Detroit Police Department as part of that.
It's contradictory to most of, you know, your two pillars of the 80s, Schwarzenegger and Stallone. Peter Weller's not your prototypical action hero.
Yeah, yeah, and it definitely works to the film's advantage, for sure. I don't think, you know, if they had gotten Schwarzenegger for this role, I don't think he would have... Maybe they would have restructured it to work around him, but I don't think he would have brought that quote-unquote everyman feel. I mean, they tried doing that with Total Recall, in the 80s and 90s, the guy didn't have an everyman feel. You know what I'm saying? So I think that definitely works to this film's advantage that he's not.
Yeah, you also you have to wonder how much Terminator he would have pulled performance-wise if it would have been that cold and that robotic, if there would have been any ounce of humanity before he gets shot up. Mm-hmm. It's kind of something interesting to think about.
Thank you for your cooperation. Good day.
I cringe just thinking about that. Or this, Patrick, or this would have been the start of Cool Party. I like these intro scenes, boys. I like the talk of the funeral as, you know, we got name tags just taken off. And, of course, Lewis beating up a suspect and meeting Murphy for the first time. We see Lewis, played by Nancy Allen. It's weird. When we first get introduced to her, she's wearing this helmet, so we kind of almost think she's a guy, right? But when she takes off her helmet, she's got the short hair. Another one just brings the every woman feel. She's not exactly a sex pot. I've never been a really big fan of Nancy Allen, even in Carrie, which, you know, is probably her coup de grace.
Oh, she's awful in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And she became Brian De Palma's muse. And once her and him broke up, it's like she was in like Poltergeist 3, and just she's never really been a good, quote unquote good actress. No offense, Nancy. And Nancy Allen's actually on my Facebook, so I'm worried about this.
I'll give her this. She's very good in Blowout. I think that's her best performance.
Agreed. But I think she works in this movie. I think her every girl feel. I think if you would have put a sex bot in here, if you would have put like an 87 Sharon Stone or somebody in this role, I don't think they would have worked as well. I think Nancy Allen, again, works perfectly for what they put her in here.
I think it's even an interesting choice to make his partner female, because the character itself could have been male.
Absolutely.
She's also not Ripley.
Yes, although she does kick a little ass in these opening scenes. I mean, she's taking on the suspect, you know. I think that's something Ripley would do. They give her that feminine feel, too, where they have her popping the gum, which I've always hated. I hate when chicks do that. I fucking hate it. Then they bring that back later on in the series, too.
The Sarah Connor gun cock.
Oh, gross. We then get the intro to the Ed 209 model, which isn't necessarily in working order. Here we go, boys. Here's where we get our intro to the quote-unquote over-the-top nature of Verhoeven's violence, right? Mm. Like, this guy, he puts down the gun, yet Ed 209 doesn't recognize it, and as he gets shot, blood just splatters the fucking screen, and I, quite frankly, never really liked this scene. It's just so goddamn over-the-top.
I loved it.
I know a lot of people love this stuff, but I don't like it.
You forget, I was 12. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's true.
I love it just because I miss blood squibs in movies. One of my biggest pet peeves with modern movies is the digital squibs, where it looks so fake. Like, I look at the Expendables movies,
yeah,
where it's like you already have a digital muzzle flash, and then you put a digital squib on top of it, it just looks 10 times worse. And I think RoboCop is a movie that just goes to 11 all the time. I don't think there's ever a violent moment where they show restraint or pull back. It's always full throttle, and I do have to admire that to some degree. It's, yeah. If you're gonna go big, go all the way. Don't constantly walk that line.
It's what makes RoboCop RoboCop. I love the fact that this was before CGI, so they actually did the Ed 209 very like stop motion style.
Phil Tippett,
yeah, who had
big name back in the 80s. He did the Star Wars. He did the Walkers and Star Wars, and he's done a lot of things over his career. He definitely brings something to this character, to this Ed 209. It makes him a character. You don't see these stop motion vehicles, especially back in the 80s. You don't see them be quote unquote characters, but there's a character trait he gives this thing that we'll talk about later. That I think it's the first time I ever saw like a stop motion model become a character. You know, but then like you go back to it. Matt, you were talking about that, you know, go way out. But do we really need to have somebody just yell out, like, go get a paramedic as this guy's, like, shot up to shit? Like, I mean, I think that's the stuff I'm just like, ah, groan. But again, as Batch said, he was 12, so he probably loved this shit.
Yeah. Also goes, like, the tone of, like, what scumbags OCP are up to their employees.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. I do feel we're talking about the over-the-topness. I feel the seediness in this film, I think it works to its advantage at this point. You know, it had a real slickness to them, you know, Predator and Die Hard being prime examples. But as I mentioned earlier, like the 70s feel to this movie, it's an aspect that I think really works to its advantage. I like how crazy these characters really are, you know. Some of these characters you could just see in Deliverance, you know, like those 70s movies. And, you know, that's one thing I will give to it, give to its advantage. We see Murphy trolling his gun, like his son's favorite character, DJ Laser. This is one thing about this movie I love. I think they needed more of these, quite frankly, these little character moments, which I feel are just too far in between. And what I also like is that they never make Murphy and Lewis a romantic foil. Like,
exactly.
That would have been the thing to do back then, right? I mean, is to make them, you know, have this real attraction to each other. And then when he gets shot up, she wants to save her quote unquote boyfriend, but no, it's not that way. And that's one thing that I really, really like about this movie.
You need to show his humanity before he turns into RoboCop. And I do agree with you. That's kind of my one criticism of this movie, is that I would have liked to see a little bit more of his family life, but at the same time, you got a 100-minute movie and you have to wonder how much was left on the cutting room floor. I mean, especially considering that this movie, I believe, when it first screened, was rated X.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he had to cut a lot out.
It's funny because with the way they introduced Alex Murphy, you really don't know that much about him, so it makes it all the more tragic when he does start to kind of get some of his memories back later in the movie, and you find out he does have a family and all that kind of stuff.
You're right. That's a great point, Batch, because we hear him say, you know, he's got a son and these kinds of things. But, you know, I didn't even think about that, but what a great way to frame the story is that we don't really know that much about him. But, you know, he does turn into this machine later on. That's the way they frame it, is they put the memories in, and that's how you get to know him. That's a great point that I never really looked at. I think now the story is actually starting to make sense. To
that's what I do. You're going to love this movie by the time I'm done with it.
I think I've already got a higher rating than when I started, quite frankly. We meet Boddicker.
Favorite all-time villains in a movie.
Yes, he's a fantastic, fantastic villain. I love him in this movie. He's just so goddamn grossly overstated, but this is when the over-topness kind of works for me. And then we also see Twin Peaks' very own Wei Weiss.
Yep.
This guy would go on to be in Twin Peaks. That's where I would most know him from.
I've only seen the movie. I know him from Swamp Thing, too.
Oh, shit, that's right. I forgot.
He wasn't Swamp Thing. Oh, my God.
He played Swamp Thing.
Yeah, he was Swamp Thing. He was the actual Swamp Thing in it. Yeah, he was the hero. We see the a pretty good action scene of Murphy and Lewis chasing Boddicker on the road. I think this stuff is gold. I really, really dig this. Like, he says, "Can you fly, Bobby?" as he throws him out the car and the twisting of the car to the warehouse. This stuff's great.
But I think that's why one of the things that makes this movie so rewatchable for me is that it's quotable.
Yeah, it has a lot of good one-liners.
Like, a lot of lines, yeah.
And it's not just one catchphrase. Like, you look at Terminator where it's "I'll be back" or "Die Hard," "Yippee-ki-yay," "Mother effer." RoboCop's got a boatload of them.
And everybody's got a catchphrase.
Absolutely. Murphy pursues them, and it gets an utterly brutal end as Lewis gets knocked off a balcony. Murphy gets blindsided. He gets utterly pulverized. Though I do like the little seeds planted here that will grow later, like the line Murphy uses, you know, "Dead or alive, you're coming with me." Mm-hmm. Some of this is pretty good, but the whole parallel of Murphy getting his hand shot off and the quote-unquote "dying for our sins," this stuff gets kind of way heavy-handed for a movie that's, you know, all about the over-the-top violence.
Yeah, he had to cut a little bit of that hand getting shot off for the X rating.
Yeah, and that whole scene, first time I saw it, made me physically ill. Like, it's very graphic. Part of it's just because it's practical, and you know there's no artificiality to it as far as a computer effect. They actually built stuff and destroy it. So kind of seeing that for the first time kind of shocked me in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Again, I was 12, so it was awesome. You know, this movie kind of explains a lot about me.
Yeah, it really does, now that I get to it. But the whole, like, "give the man a hand" line, the way this thing was shot, the loud, obnoxious laughter of that one black thug.
They're all assholes.
See, they're all assholes, but see, that was something maybe I loved when I was 12, but now I watch this, I find it obnoxious.
I disagree. I think it's great because Boddicker just revels in being evil, and he's unapologetic about it. And I like how he's, like, mocking him, where he's like, "Does it hurt?"
No shades of gray in that gang. All black.
What's that?
There's no shades of gray in that gang. They're all black.
Absolutely not. So when Murphy gets to the hospital, they're trying to revive him. I do like the flashbacks we're getting. We're seeing his wife for the first time, and scenes of her are undercut with the scene in the warehouse. And I do like how Verhoeven, he fades the screen to black when Murphy, quote-unquote, dies. And he puts the screen up in a TV static way when he is revived. So we don't really see the building of RoboCop. We just kind of see it from his point of view when he wakes up. And I do really like that framing device. I think it's really well done.
In a weird kind of construction montage.
Yes.
It's an inverted montage, because instead of the montage of him being put together, you just see it from Murphy's perspective.
Absolutely. We would see it. We would see him actually get built, right? But now they don't do that. And I do like the way they say it from his point of view. I think that's really well done.
Yeah, I agree. If they did this now, or most times they do this, it's a shot. You're looking from a ceiling perspective. So I like that they shot it from his POV.
I really like Miguel Ferrer in this movie, too.
Yes, I'm definitely. I was just about ready to talk to him about him. Actually, like he looks at the camera. He says, "You're gonna be a bad motherfucker." Like, that's a great moment. He's really good in this, because you see him, and it's almost like you think he's gonna be like a bad guy, right? You think he's gonna be like one of the bad guys, but no, he's actually a good protagonist for RoboCop here. Like, he kind of came up with the concept, and he's gonna go against everything that Jones and everybody on OCP side are for. And I think that's a really, really good character.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, though, he is still part of that corporate machine and the kind of the perils and moralistics of corporate, you know, espionage.
He's still a scumbag, but he's our scumbag.
Yeah. Another Twin Peaks alumni, ironically.
maybe David Lynch just loved this movie so much he had to get, like, everybody from this movie into his show. I also like how Verhoeven's teasing us with RoboCop here. Yes, we would have seen what RoboCop looked like in trailers and photos and things, but it's not until we hear the Robo walk, right? And we see him walk right past the glass, and we get a really good look at him.
And I love how all the cops just totally fucking beeline it.
Metal.
Yeah.
What's that?
I love how all the cops just fucking beeline it when he actually comes in the building.
The look of him, the metallic metal, the way his weapons are formatted on his armor. And this also, it must be said, just to get a little bit behind the scenes. Boys, I watched this movie 3 times for this podcast, including one with commentary. There was a huge battle contention between Verhoeven and makeup artist Rob Bottin. The way this suit was coming out, Verhoeven just wasn't happy with it, and him and Bottin really got into it a bunch of times. They would eventually make up and work on Total Recall together. But I find, I think all the contention is, it pays off pretty well here, because I think the suit is ingenious. I'd almost call it brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the main reason the character lasts as long as he does after this film is because of the way this character is built. It's just so well done.
Well, didn't Verhoeven want it to be allow for more mobility and agility? So, like, it was my understanding that he wanted it to be more like Spider-Man, to where he was a lot more athletic when he was taking down criminals.
Mm-hmm. But you couldn't do that in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, Rob Bottin is one of the best ever. I mean, this is the guy who did John Carpenter's The Thing, Total Recall, which has one of my favorite, like, scenes where they get sucked out into Mars and they look like Tex Avery cartoons.
Yep, yep.
I think just in terms of design for RoboCop, it works more because he's supposed to be designed for combat, so he should be like a walking tank.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love how they based the helmet on Judge Dredd.
Yes, I caught that too.
Was that intentional? I didn't catch any of that on the commentaries or anything. I wonder if that was intentional. Was the comic even out back then?
The comic first started in the late 70s.
Oh, okay.
Although we were still years removed from the first movie.
We learned that RoboCop eats baby food, and we see his quote-unquote RoboVision. We also learn of his prime directives.
Which, is that shit gluten-free?
What's that?
Is that gluten-free, the baby food?
Well, can I ask a question about the baby food? Because you mentioned the dying for your sins being too on the nose. Do you think the baby food is too synonymous with him being reborn from birth and having to readjust to life through baby food like he's an infant again?
Boy, you know what? I never thought about that, but now that you mention it, you're not far off. Listen to Verhoeven talk on the commentary. He's a real interesting guy, because here's a guy, look at the stuff that comes out of this fucker's head, right? I mean, you have this movie, Total Recall, which you've mentioned a lot on this podcast, Starship Troopers, all that stuff has just...
Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct.
Showgirls.
Showgirls, all seedy, over-the-top, gratuitous films. But you listen to the guy talk, you almost feel like he goes to church every Sunday, because all this stuff was very intentional. Now, the baby food, he didn't mention, but I'm pretty sure you're dead on with that. So just the fact that he's as religious as he is and has the sensibilities that he does makes him just one of the most fascinating directors in the history of cinema. I'll just go ahead and say that. So you might be dead on with that. We learn of RoboCop's prime directives, which is serve the public trust, protect the innocent, and uphold the law. Though another seed is planted here, because we see in his RoboVision that there's a fourth prime directive, that which for now is classified, and we'll learn more about that later. Ingenious plot device. Love the way they frame that. We are also introduced to RoboCop's gun, which is great, and Murphy notices that. Oh, not Murphy. Lewis notices that he trolls it like his son's character into his holster. This is great stuff, man. This is great stuff. And again, I wish there was more of this stuff. I really do. I know that the sensibility of the 80s didn't really allow it, but more of this stuff. And we'll probably, if I do remember correctly, we do get a lot more of it in the remake. It would really work to its advantage when the over-the-top stuff does happen. So we see a Superman-type montage of a RoboCop saving people. I think out of all of them, I think the preventing of the rape obviously stands out. But I think Verhoeven's over-the-top style works best in the scene of him preventing the robbery, right? Just, I like that first scene a lot. You know, this guy's watching television, he's laughing at the television, and here comes this motherfucker just coming in, just robbing the place. Oh, what's he going to get, like $200 out of this fucking drawer? Maybe. You know?
Not a good day.
Yeah. Good day, exactly. They don't have anything in their till, if anything at all. If you put $100 on the table, they fucking look at you like you're nuts.
Yeah.
But going back to the prevented rape real quick, I do love how unemotional that Robo is, right? As he tells the woman that she has suffered an emotional shock and he'll notify a crisis center. Like, there's almost like a dark comedy edge to this, right? As you're watching this.
Well, yeah, considering he just shot the guy in the balls right between her legs.
Sure. That's definitely more of the dark comedy as well.
Well, that scene touches on why I consider this a superhero movie.
Yep.
And Batch, you can kind of talk about this if you want. Every superhero needs a tragic flaw. His tragic flaw is the very idea of singularity. It's that when you join human and machine, when does one take hold of the other? And does it create one meshed being, or do you have two sides at war? And it's
absolutely
that, yes, he has both, but he can't reconnect with humanity. In the same way that he's not 100% machine. It's like he's cursed almost.
Yeah, he doesn't know that he's Murphy yet. Right now he's just following his programming. The other side hasn't seeped through yet to integrate.
That scene in particular doesn't surprise me, considering we were still in the midst of the Paul Kersey Death Wish mode of vigilantism in a lot of movies, so it's kind of following suit, just adding a more cyberpunk aesthetic to it.
Mm. He also saves a hostage situation, which was certainly interesting. I do like how we are wondering how he's going to help, and he just reaches through the wall for him and punches him through a window, which I thought was... I laughed out loud at that.
Just walks in like, I got this.
Yeah. We didn't see another newscast of him, and then he just kind of looks at the camera and he tells kids to stay out of trouble.
Which is funny because this movie was marketed heavily to kids.
Abso-fucking-lutely, yes.
I was 12.
I mean, you had video games, you had toys, and the video game, that side-scroll video game was fucking badass, by the way.
It as was a pretty side decent, note. Yeah.
I fucking love that video game. Go to the arcade. It was so awesome. And then also, it's funny because, you know, he tells kids to stay out of trouble. And the very next scene, what is it? It's an advertisement for the game Nukem.
Yep.
Fucking great.
Which is also very heavy-handed given that we were, you know, a couple years before Watchmen was written. And that was all about the threat of nuclear Armageddon.
Oh, and, yes.
Like, I can't speak because I didn't live through that. But I just from listening to, you know, my parents or whoever, everyone thought that, oh, Reagan's going to push the button any day. So that... To put it out there that broadly, I think that's very admirable, but at the same time, incredibly on the nose. The title Nukem itself.
Batch, I don't know if you went through this in Canada, but we in the United States, around this time, we had a drill that in case there was a nuclear fire, we had to get under our desks.
Seriously? What good is that going to do?
Absolutely nothing. But the same thing we did...
Remember, there were no refrigerators in classrooms.
Oh, yeah. Because we all know that's the one thing that's going to save you, right?
I don't know. Ask George Lucas. I think it works.
Hey, that was a part of retrospective. We did that retrospective last year. Stop it. Yeah, that was what we did. Like, but that just the fact that we did a quote-unquote nuclear drill put the fear of nuclear war in my head. That was a huge thing in the 80s. Like, you're right. Maybe Reagan could push that button. Hell, I'm feeling that right now. I think 45 can push that fucking button any fucking time.
He's got the best button, okay? So, he's got the shiniest button.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, I'm right by my desk. I'm all set to go under it in case it fucking happens. Yeah, so that fear was there. So I think this kind of taps into that in a darkly comic way. But I think you're right, Matt. I think it is a little heavy-handed given what we were going through at that time. So Miguel Ferrer, he's promoted. And I do like how he gets caught talking shit about Dick Jones by Dick Jones. Ferrer's friend just kind of walks out even before he's done.
Dick Jones could be one of the greatest names for one of the bad guys in the movie. Just fucking Dick Jones.
I don't know. Ronnie Cox's real name is almost as badass.
Jones puts him in his place, saying Ed 209 was a guaranteed moneymaker, and Bob stepped all over it, but with his noodle machine. We see Robo having nightmares about his death, and Weller plays these scenes pretty nicely as he sees his death and walks out. I like the way that scene comes out rather well. Again, as Batch pointed out, it humanizes him in a way. Fitting, this is right after Jones warns Bob that he better not screw up, right? So Jones warns Bob in the prior scene, you're... fucking machine better not screw up. And the very next scene, what's he do?
He screws up.
RoboCop has a nightmare. He walks right the fuck out against his operator's orders. I think that's pretty well done. I like how Verhoeven films RoboCop. It's almost always from the chest up, right? It's giving him like an imposing presence. I don't think future directors did this. And I think that really, really works to the character's advantage.
I think that's intentional thematically because he has an artificial heart. So shooting it from the perspective of where his heart would be, that's how I read it at least.
Yeah, man. I always loved the spike that he had in his hand for the interface. I thought that was cool as hell.
Oh, fuck yeah.
It makes me question, though, did they install that in the computer system just for him? Other than what else would fucking use that?
Fuck, I don't know. I don't know, maybe. Lewis appeals to Robo's self-conscious, saying that he is actually Murphy. Funny, I never saw Murphy as Anakin Skywalker trying to come out of this machine, but I guess that's how the writers saw him and how Verhoeven saw him. But again... Matt, wouldn't more of this work to the movie's advantage? Like, all this stuff? This stuff's great.
Oh, absolutely. But I think the fact that it leaves you wanting more, I don't think that's a bad thing in this case, because there's so many different levels that this movie works on, both on a purely visceral level and also on a subtextual level. So I think it's fine. I mean, could I have used more of it? Absolutely. But I would have watched a full 3-hour cut of this movie.
I think if you had more, it would really affect the pacing of this movie, because this movie does go along at a decent pace.
Oh, like, yes.
Nothing
yes.
really drags it down.
No. Batch, remember the days when movies were, you know, under 2 hours?
Yeah.
Blockbuster movies were under 2 hours? Fucking glorious.
What is that like? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
In our day.
This movie is 100, like, I think it's about an hour and 40 minutes or so.
Yeah, 102 and you're right. minutes.
It fucking moves so quick.
We could see two movies in an afternoon and be home for dinner.
Yeah, and you know what? You know, and I know it's kind of ironic, because I'm sitting here, I'm complaining, yeah, more character moments will work, more character moments will work. I understand that, but the more I think about it, you pad this movie out, and we might get to that when we get to the remake. You pad this movie out, and I think it affects its overall, you know, what we come away with it. So I think just the pacing of it is what makes this movie what it is. The editing's great, the directing's really good, and I think it really works to the movie's advantage.
Yeah, there's not a wasted moment either. I mean, can certainly say that there are more, the rediscovering his humanity, Garrett, you may say that's more interesting, but mm-hmm. the stuff that the additional content is not just filler, and it's not just padding. It mm-hmm. plays an important part in the movie. So I'm glad that, yeah, the pacing doesn't sacrifice story convention, but pose a question. What was the last blockbuster that wasn't a 2.5-hour juggernaut?
Oh, I can't
remember. Like, I can think of Dunkirk. That was under 2 hours.
Yeah, that'd be the one I'd think of too.
Because I remember sitting down, I checked the IMDb runtime, and I'm like, oh my god, this is an hour and 45 minutes. What the hell is happening?
That is almost a full hour less than Interstellar. Can you believe that?
Or Dark Knight Rises. Even mm-hmm. the new Star Wars movie, that was what, 220, 230?
Yeah, uh-huh, absolutely.
Just, you don't get movies like this anymore. I mean, even the whole idea, one of the reasons why... probably my favorite element about this movie, and we touched on it a little bit, is that all of the side characters are incredibly memorable.
Mm-hmm.
They all have distinct personalities. They're certainly very heightened, but they stand out amidst your two pillars, kind of with Weller and probably say Kurtwood Smith. Like the closest movie I could think of as far as a 90s comparison for me is Face Off. And that's also...
Jeez.
Well, the reason I say that is that it's incredibly bombastic. The violence is, it's a hard R, much like RoboCop, and all the side characters stand out.
I'd say Predator as well.
Ironically, the same Summer. I mean, by the way, Summer 87, one of the best ever. RoboCop, Lethal Weapon, Predator, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Beverly Hills Cop 2, The Hidden. Just a great summer all around. Like, I would kill to go back in a time machine.
Hell of a deal.
Oh, it was fantastic. Batch, how are you feeling about this pace, Ben? You going along with this pace? You really like this pace? I'm sure, you know, as a precautious, what were you, 12 when you watched this? I'm sure, you know, you didn't need more of these character moments. You wanted, like, the more action, quote-unquote. But even as an adult, are you actually going with this pace?
Yeah, I like it because it gives us just enough of every single character. We know where they're coming from. We know who we are. We know that Dick Jones is an asshole. We know Murphy's starting to wake up. We know his partner's trying to break through to Murphy. We know Terrence is going to be doing something evil probably later on in this movie. Nobody wears out their welcome.
And he trusts the audience to pick up the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, I wish more directors would do that now too, actually. So Emil goes to a gas station to rob it, and we come upon the scene that almost got the movie shut down. As Emil recognizes the slogan, Dead or Alive, You're Coming With Me, it gives Robo pause, and even as he has a clear path to freedom, Emil crashes his bike right as the massive explosion happens, which this fucking thing, I think it set other buildings on fire, and I think they wanted to shut the movie down right after.
No, that's a fire.
Yeah, no shit. Really good scene, though. I really like this scene a lot. Is it too on the nose, quote unquote, that Murphy's saying, "Dead or Alive, You're Coming With Me," just like he did when he saw them before? Maybe. But I think it gives the character a really good recognition tool. You know, it's like, oh shit, we fucking killed you. Like, what are you doing now? Like, what are you're seeing it from his point of view, and you're like, holy fuck, this thing's coming at me, and I don't know what the fuck to do.
It really gets the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm. We are then introduced to Robo's middle finger / knife mm-hmm. / database login as he finds the people responsible for his death. It's funny because the first time we're introduced to this, it's like a joke. But when we see it later, it becomes a huge part of the movie later on. But here, like, I used to laugh at this scene a lot when he just pulls out his hand. He makes a fist and here it comes like a middle finger. I thought that was pretty cool. Here we go again, Matt. Another revenge tale, right? He finds who's responsible for for his death. And this is the shit we found in Hannibal Rising. It's the same shit.
The fact that you mentioned that movie just gave me an aneurysm.
So is the saying now RoboCop did it first?
Yeah, probably. Murphy slash RoboCop goes to his house as he gets confirmation of who he is. And this is, again, this is stuff I want more of. This movie is only a hair over an hour and 40 minutes, as we mentioned. But a few more minutes of this, as well as confirmation that his wife recognizes him or something. Like, something. Where does his wife go? Do they even say where she is?
That's what sequels are for.
They just say the wife and the son moved away.
Yeah.
I could have used more of it, although the score is helping with the tragic element and making me feel for the character.
That said, the score for this movie is great, particularly the theme they came up with.
Oh, man. Fuck, that thing's an earworm, too. I can't stop fucking singing it.
Like, I put that alongside, like, the Raiders March or the Superman theme. Like, when I hear that music, I instantaneously think of RoboCop.
Agreed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this guy, Basil Panderas? I know I'm butchering that. Just a guy whose scores I don't really recognize, but this is, if you're going to have a score on your fucking resume, this is the one to have. And,
he did one of my 10 favorite movies ever.
Which is?
Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's one of your 10 favorite movies ever, really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess we know what retrospective we're going to do in the summer.
It's in my top 15. Pencil me in for that.
Oh, my God, you guys.
Self high five.
There you go.
Robo finds Ray Weiss at apparently the same club the Terminator shot up in that first Terminator film.
They got it up and running, though, fairly quickly.
I do like the fact that the dad from Twin Peaks is fucking hanging out at a CD fucking club like this.
Whole lot of coke in that club.
A lot of coke in this movie, period.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's how you knew it was the 80s.
Uh-huh. Meanwhile, Bobby is having fun with some hookers. Speaking of coke, as Boddicker, you know, he's having these hookers and cocaine just roaming around this fucking place. I love the 80s, man, because you just show this shit over and over. There were so many films of this. I think Scarface was like the over-the-top version, but like it was, since then, like people were like, oh, yeah, we'll just put coke in ours, too. Like it was everywhere back in the 80s. So Boddicker shows up and gives us the classic line, bitches leave.
Yeah.
He then shoots Bob up, and here's where we learn that Boddicker and Jones have been in cahoots the entire time. And this is a plot point that was real popular in the 80s, right, Batch? Like, yep. Huge corporations with power funding the other bad guy, making the head bad guy a pawn in the game, so to speak. This stuff, I mean, it was all over the fucking place.
Well, it's also kind of the James Bond model of you have your main antagonist that's usually the head of some organization, then you have your heavyweight henchman.
Yeah.
That does all the dirty work. I mean, but even we saw this in action movies. I mean, right after this, we had Lethal Weapon 2, where like the government was in on it. But even before this, it was everywhere.
So RoboCop invades the warehouse, takes out a lot of thugs. And I do like the bit where one of the guys, as he falls, takes out one of his own guys with his gun that he accidentally fires. Like, that stuff. That's only Verhoeven, right? I mean, that could only come from Verhoeven's head, this kind of shit. You go back to, like, the guy getting thrown out of the car, too. Like, all these bad guys are just taking each other out, you know? So Robo gets his hands on Boddicker, throws him through windows, and gets out of Boddicker that he works for Dick Jones right before arresting him. Robo pays Jones a visit, and it is here, boys, that we learn what Prime Directive 4 is, as it prevents Robo from arresting and or firing upon a senior OCP officer.
Of course you knew they were going to put that in there, just in case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what? It's funny because, as I said, the seed was planted earlier, but I think the way it's revealed here is like Jones, Ronnie Cox, by the way, who's another Total Recall guy, and he was another guy. He was in a lot of dramas back in the 70s. This was like the start of him being in these crazy action films.
Yeah.
But like he's just standing there like, okay, come and arrest me. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, is he like going to shoot him? Is Ed 209 right behind him? Which Ed 209 ends up being behind him, but that's not what his plan is. His plan is to just have him approach him and boom. It's like, it's almost like, I don't know. I hate to bring this up, but in Man of Steel, when Superman was like in his ship and he's hurt by his own environment, that's almost the way I feel when RoboCop's like down on his knees and he's like,
very much so.
He's writhing in pain.
Well, it's smart. It's smart on the part of OCP because it's an automatic failsafe, and you could certainly trace that to, you know, a whole splooge of, you know, these big business breakdowns like Enron, where not everyone went down with the ship. Some people got off scot-free.
Mm-hmm. You have to know that Steve Jobs has a kill switch in every single person's iPhone, right?
Oh, like Kingsman? Yeah.
Yes.
I do like how Willer's playing this, guys. Like, I mean, he is writhing in pain, you know? It is then that he gets attacked by Yat-209, who, along with a major OCP task force, just completely destroys Robo. And
blows the shit out of
him. The way Verhoeven... Oh, man, he shot the shit, didn't he?
Yeah.
The way Verhoeven's filming this, like, it's a real tragedy, right? Like, the way we see his eye in close-up, the helpless reaching out amongst dust and fog. Though, of course, amongst all this... And here's the character trait I was pointing out earlier. At 209, he's like, he reaches down and he almost puts his foot out to feel where the stairs are. Like, where would you see that? What in the stop? Do you know how much work a stop motion fucking animation is?
Yes.
Like, where would you see, like, them, the animators just say, okay, we got to make him, like, just feel around for these stairs because he doesn't know where he is. But it's a perfect character trait for this thing because it's almost like a baby, right? Mm-hmm. It's an immature baby who's like a killing machine. And that's exactly what he would do. And, of course, what happens? He falls down the fucking stairs. It's glorious.
As useless as a fucking Dalek with scares.
Yeah,
well,
it's sort of the equivalent of putting a hole in the middle of the Death Star. It's like that, it's like that one weakness. Oh, no, stairs.
Yeah. Also goes to show you how short-sighted the OCP is in the designs, because they never even thought that, oh, we're going to have to figure out how these things navigate stairs. They just wanted to get the contract made.
Yeah, and I love how he's, like, throwing a tantrum at the bottom of these stairs. Like, this is all stuff that's, like, it's real what-the-fuck moments, but it's stuff that I love. You know, I think it just works for this movie. And that shot of RoboCop just crawling, writhing, and then going down each level in a gradual set of motions, all this stuff is just, again, is it heavy-handed? Is Verhoeven filming it in a heavy-handed way? Yes. But all the stuff that we're seeing, like the small seeds that have been planted, like, this makes it a completely tragic set of circumstances for him.
Would you guys say that, like, all this pain that Murphy's going through right now is waking him up more and more from just being the machine? Because it's got to be a shock to the system with it. Because he slowly gets coming to, but with that directive, that kind of just puts so much pain in then getting all shot up. So when he starts putting himself back together, that's when he's really starting to integrate himself as Murphy.
Great point. I didn't think about it, but you're probably dead on with that.
Oh, I just thought of it as realizing that the machines are not perfect.
Boddicker comes to see Jones, and I love how he just kind of puts gum on the secretary's name tag. That's a fucking great moment that I didn't even remember.
Boddicker does not give a fuck.
No, he doesn't. He says he'll have some time for her later. Like, this shit's just fucking awesome.
You wouldn't get a scene like that nowadays.
No, this motherfucker, he's just the scummiest asshole out there, right? But yet, he's so fucking... One of the best bad men in the history of film, I would say.
And still, like, last time I saw this movie, is all I can think is, that's Red fucking Foreman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what's funny is, you listen to the commentary of this, and you remember stuff from the Dead 70s show, like, everybody says how nice of a guy he is.
Yeah.
Well, most people who play villains are the nicest people. And I think it's just because they get it out of their system.
Yeah.
You might be right about that. But it's just funny just seeing him, just how seedy and scummy he is in this movie. It's fucking awesome. Now, as he visits Jones, I ask you guys something. What exactly is it that Jones wants and what Robo was preventing? Like, what is the big plot that Jones has here? Because I couldn't really get it from watching it this time.
I think he's just jealous that the Ed 209s didn't get picked up, and he just sees the Robo as a way of just get Robo out of his way, then he can continue getting his contract and business as usual.
I think it's more of a mix of, he wants the military contracts, but I think his big end game, that whole subplot about the real estate development, where they talk about, like, they want it to be Delta City, I think is what they call it.
Yes.
I mean, speaking of things that they predicted, I mean, you look at a city like Dubai. And how quickly that came up out of nowhere. So, again, that's another one of these modern societal elements that this movie picked up on.
Dick Jones is playing the long game.
Yeah. Lewis takes Robo to a steel mill, and she brings him some tools, his gun, and, of course, baby food. Yep. And here is some nightmare juice as Robo takes off his mask. And let me tell you, boys, Return of the Jedi came out, like, what, 4 years before this, and it was almost a disappointment when he took off his mask, and it just seemed like he would have been just, you know, it seemed like that would have been more ghastly than the guy that they saw underneath, right? Mm-hmm. Here, Rob Bottin, he's created just this nightmarish vision who's, I tell you what, I looked at this, and I'm watching it on this viewing right before this podcast, And I'm trying to see if I see seams, right? Like the old 80s makeup, you could see the seams, even like the great horror films and of the day. Like you see seams of the makeup and everything. Here, guys, this feels so goddamn organic and real. I can't fucking see any of it. This is one of the best makeup jobs I've ever seen.
And I love it because it's all practical.
Yeah. Quite a feat.
Yeah, I mean, there's two pillars, I think, of practical makeup, especially during this period. One is Rob Bottin, and the other is Chris Wallace, who did Cronenberg's The Fly. Like, that's such a lost art
form. Oh, yeah, Chris Wallace.
Yeah, Chris Wallace. That's such a lost art form nowadays. I mean, we get good makeup effects nowadays, but with computer effects, it's just so much easier and so much more time efficient to do it that way, and it's kind of a lost art.
You also look at, like, when he takes that helmet off, that's the first time we actually see, this is Murphy, this is what Murphy is right now, and it actually gives Peter Weller a chance to emote with his face and his eyes, where he was just kind of behind that whole shell as Robocop the whole movie.
Matt, bringing up the makeup effects from back then, I was one of the people who, when we started our movie, I was one of the people who pushed for, okay, we have a zombie scene, but I want it all to be practical. Like, I don't want any digital effects here. None. But I got to tell you guys, you try putting one of those scenes together and get the continuity of stains and blood and where it is.
Yeah, I can imagine.
With each passing scene. And then, like, 8 hours later, you're supposed to have it on the same exact spot on her face as before. We finally just threw up our hands. We said, fuck it. We did a lot of it digitally. It's the worst thing you could say in a film. Like, we'll just fix it in post. We'll fix it in post. Guess what? We fixed a lot of that in post because it's such a pain in the fucking ass. Which is why I look at these with a more respected eye, because I didn't realize till I got into it just how fucking hard it is to get the continuity and stuff down. And I'm less harsh on that now than I was back then, because it is extremely difficult. So that's what makes Rob Bottin such a marvel at his job, is that he was able to do this kind of stuff. And the way it just comes off on screen and the blood splatters and stuff is just so fucking great.
I wonder if that's why you look at some of the big franchises of the 80s, like Friday the 13th and Halloween, why they went with masks, because it's, you don't have to worry about continuity with the makeup effects. Whereas,
yeah, it's just easy.
You look at something like Freddy Krueger, where it looks different every single movie because you have a different artist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting perspective that you have that you mentioned.
Boddicker meets up with his clan once again and introduces his new gun by blowing up his guy's car.
Which I like it.
Yes. You know, it's funny. I watched this and I thought of like another 48 hours, because there's a scene where Eddie Murphy, he gets his new car, he unlocks it and it fucking blows up in front of him. Same exact situation here. The guy's showing off his new car. What does Boddicker do? He just fucking blows it up. It's so great. And then, of course, what they have to do, since this is a Verhoeven film, they had to blow up a porn shop.
Yep.
Great stuff. Meanwhile, Robo sets up his food to practice his targeting system. And I do like how, amongst all this, we do get, again, no hints of a romance at all between these two. In fact, it's almost more of a mother-son relationship, isn't it? Because you have the mother feeding the son baby food. It almost has that kind of feel, to me anyway.
Yeah.
I guess Batch is against that idea.
I think that's a bit of a reach, but
I just respect the way they treated the relationship in this. Again, I'm just going to mention that again.
I looked at it as like a husband and wife almost, where you're helping someone recuperate from a horrible accident or like a stroke or something.
Yeah, nursing him back to health. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. I can see that. So here we go, guys. The big monumental, conclusive, climactic fight breaks out. And there's some really good stuff here. Though, again,
one scene in particular, one of the greatest death scenes ever put to film.
Yeah,
that we'll traumatized the hell out of me because I was 12 at the time.
Oh, my God. And of course, Toxic Avenger was out back then. So, yeah. Like, you're seeing this. Well, we'll get to that here in a little bit. Let me just say that I think the symbolism of him walking on the water, again, very heavy-handed. But then we get the over-the-top Toxic Avenger-type change that Emil makes after getting rammed into toxic waste. Another huge thing in the 80s was just toxic waste, right?
The rejuvenating powers of toxic waste.
That just happened to be laying around this warehouse.
It brought back Jason Voorhees. It brought back the Toxic Avenger.
Joker.
Oh, that's right, Joker.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Batch?
Oh, that just happened to be laying around this warehouse. Well, it is Detroit, so.
Boddicker hits him with his car, again, killing his own guy. And then we just see the guy just turn into a huge batch of sludge.
Of that is he turns on the windshield wipers.
Yeah, that was the exclamation point, wasn't it? I will say the suspense here is pretty good, though, as Robo goes after Boddicker, and we feel for a slight instance that Wei Weiss might get Robo with the falling steel, but then Lewis just kind of takes him out, and we then get what his middle finger key was really good for, as he cuts Boddicker in the neck, and I love how this blood's just spraying everywhere. I mean, this is fucking brutal stuff.
It's a good death.
Absolutely, yeah. And this, for a guy who's been so fucking seedy and as big of a fucking asshole as he's been this entire movie, it's a fitting end, right? And then there's a what I think is probably my favorite line in this movie, probably in the entire series, where Lewis says, you know, I'm a mess, I can't get up. And Robo just says to her, they'll fix you. They fix everything. That's just strong line that I didn't really think about how much meaning was behind it. But I really liked the way it came off watching it this time. So, but this isn't all, guys. Because even after all of this just climactic mess, in a good way, by the way, we needed to see Jones, the main bad guy, get his comeuppance, right? Here we do. After Robo takes out Ed 209 with Boddicker's gun, he moves to the meeting in time to bust Jones for what he admitted to, which is having him fired and then getting thrown out a window, which was another huge thing in the 80s, right? I mean, this was the year before Die Hard, and Die Hard would more than likely perfect it, you know? It looked better in Die Hard. Here, I don't think it looks that good as Jones is falling out the window, but it gets the job done.
I love how Robo nullifies the fourth director to get so we can actually throw him out that window.
Just a really good plot device, wasn't it? Like, yeah. He wanted to get him fired just so he could do this. Yeah. I agree, Batch. Fucking great, great end. I think this death feels earned. And then he calls himself Murphy as credits roll. So that's our movie, boys. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you guys give RoboCop? I will go to Mr. Goudreau first.
I would go pretty darn high because there's a lot to this movie that we talked about. We can argue it does go heavy-handed at times, but Verhoeven is just such a audacious filmmaker, but not in a offensive manner. At least for me, I think he's a kind of a mad genius in a lot of ways with making a movie that was not afraid of these big ideas and to be right on most of them in hindsight and to make a movie that still holds up pretty darn well. I don't hold it in the same regards as I do as a movie like the first Terminator, which came out around this time, which I was also the first binge cast I was on, but it's pretty darn close. I would give it 8.5 out of 10 faulty sets of stairs.
Faulty sets of stairs. Interesting. All right, Batch, what do you got?
I give it 9.5 bottles of baby food. Laced with
Based
Coke.
Based on what?
Laced with Coke.
Laced with Coke.
It's one of those movies from my childhood. It's awesome. It still holds up. I love the franchise. Love the character. This movie can do no wrong for me.
When we started this podcast, guys, I was going to go 6. I just wasn't vibing with the violence as much as I was when I was 12. Like, as an adult, I guess I've become that guy who tells people to get off this fucking lawn. That's the way I was feeling. But talking about it with you guys and going over it scene by scene, this is why I love doing these podcasts. I realize just the sheer magnitude of what the violence means for this film. And I think the heavy-handedness that Verhoeven brings to it was something you just did not see in movies back then. I mean, you had Raw Deal. Or Schwarzenegger, I mean, all the Commando. What was the, you know, there was no fucking side story to that movie. Schwarzenegger wanted to save his daughter. The end. Like, that's the end of that. You didn't see stuff like this back then. And I'm getting more of a joy out of it, watching it and then talking about it with you guys. I watched this movie 3 times for this podcast, and I didn't feel much of a thing for it. Going over it with you guys after watching it, though, I'm going to go 8.
Nice.
I think this movie's, it's a seedy, over-the-top junk fest. In a good way. And I think they're going to try in future sequels to bring the same exact sensibility. And we're going to see that, you know, just kind of show my hand a little bit. They can't bring the same exact thing that Verhoeven did to this movie. So it's not a movie I revisit too often. But I think after this podcast, I'm talking about it with you guys. I think it might be a more frequent visit for me. I enjoyed talking about it with you guys. And I enjoyed watching it this time. And I look forward to the sequels as
absolutely
weird and off-putting as they can be.
And then there was the time he showed up in WCW and breastfed Sting, but we're not talking about that one.
Well, that's going to come up next podcast. We're going to talk about that next time because that was the same year as RoboCop 2, but we'll get to that. All right, boys, that does it for RoboCop. This has been a sheer joy to talk about with you guys. Matt, you've been up all night, sir. I think it's time for you to go to bed. So I'm going to get out of here soon. Did you have anything else to add before I let us go here?
No, just it's nice to be back, although it feels like I never left.
No, you're not, and you're not going to leave anytime soon because I have two series coming up, which, by the way, you're going to be a part of right after this. So we'll talk about that when you're awake, though. Bats, sir, I appreciate you joining me for this.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
We have three more films to go. Will it be as much fun as this week? Let me just say that from what I remember from the three films we have coming up, they might be more fun talking about than they are going to be to watch. But I'm definitely going to watch them. The slight bits I remember, I don't remember having too much fun. I think we could have fun talking about them. So,
absolutely.
So there's a tease for next week and the weeks after. Boys, until next week, it's time for me to go deprogram. Thanks, guys.
Do you consider yourself human? I require an answer.
Stop, Dave.
Can't shoot a kid, can you, fucker?
They'll fix you. They fixed everything.
Thank you for not smoking.
Bitches leave.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
And, all right, we'll finally get to him. The host of Small Screen Heroes, the one and only, Binge Media's own, Mike Batchelor. What's going on, Batch?
Mike Batchelor, how much have you had to drink today, Garrett?
I've had a lot to drink today. No, I've just started my first Woodford Coke. But it's in a huge, I don't know if people saw the picture I posted. It's in a really big Yeti, so I'm already halfway done with it.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Yeah, of Verhoeven's sci-fi action films, the mergers that he did, I find myself gravitating, no pun intended, towards Total Recall more. Because that was the movie. That was the movie I kept watching.
Yeah, which might be another something. I was thinking about doing a Philip K. Dick looking at all the films based on his work.
Oh, good! I could just have Minority Report.
Yes.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
That's our look at our first look at RoboCop. What do you say we get into the movie, boys, and we start the retrospective off, huh?
Yeah, man.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Fuck's sake. You know what? I thought about putting that in the intro. Sidebar. I thought about putting that thing in the intro because how could you not? But I started thinking, it's like, you know what? How many times are us fucking co-hosts going to say that 100 times on these fucking podcasts?
It's going to be a drinking game by the fourth movie. So anytime anyone says that, drink. Because it's going to be subtle.
I'm already a screwdriver and a half in. So.
There you go.
Side note. Matt, screwdrivers, really? What are you, 12?
Well, compared to you guys, I'm pretty much 12.
Ain't nothing wrong with screwdrivers.
Batch, what are you drinking tonight, sir? Or are you being the good student and not drinking at all?
I am being the good student and I'm not drinking.
Ah, you poor bastard. All right.
I may have other chemicals in my system, but I plead the fifth. It's not legal up here yet, so. What's the drug from the second movie called? I'm on that. There you go.
There you go.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Or this, Patrick, or this would have been the start of Cool Potty. Okay, lost my place. Hold on.
Come quietly or there will be trouble.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
And then we also see Twin Peaks' very own Ray Wise.
Yep.
This guy would go on to be in Twin Peaks. That's where I would most know him from.
I've only seen the movie. I know him from Swamp Thing, too.
Oh, shit, that's right. I forgot.
He was in Swamp Thing. Oh, my God.
He played Swamp Thing.
Yeah, he was Swamp Thing. He was the actual Swamp Thing in it. Yeah, he was the hero.
And both of them are the...
No, just the first one.
Yeah, Return of Swamp Thing, I don't blame him for not coming back to that.
That oh, may come be a on, future, that movie's fantastic.
The best thing to come out of that movie was the Siskel and Ebert review where Roger Ebert's defense was, you didn't like the Mad Scientist Laboratory?
Oh, fuck. Heather Locklear's so fucking hot in that movie. Fuck you both. Fuck both of you. I like that movie. I don't care.
I like that movie, too.
Yeah.
That may be a future small-screen retrospective, Gary. I may drag you into.
Oh, God. If you do that on that show, I will join you for that. Actually.
There you go.
We see the...
I'd buy that for a dollar.
So Boddicker shows up and gives us the classic line, bitches leave.
Yeah.
Funny, guys. I put that down on my iPad, and it says butcher leave on my iPad. I didn't even go back and correct it. It says
maybe that's another Hannibal Rising reference.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Again, no hints of a romance at all between these two. In fact, it's almost more of a mother-son relationship, isn't it? Because you have the mother feeding the son baby food. It almost has that kind of feel, to me anyway.
Yeah.
I guess Batch is against that idea.
I think that's a bit of a reach, but...
Well, fuck off. Well, you know, we're...
You're violating the Prime Directive.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
You've been listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on BingeMedia.net. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Buy some merch at BingeMedia.net/shop. Subscribe to our newsletter at BingeMedia.net/newsletter. And don't forget...
I can't get enough of soup.
Bob Odenkirk.